All rivers at night are melancholy, sentimental, sad, like emblems of the mystery and unreality of human things. Under their spell, we seem to see things larger than our own small selves. Leonard Woolf. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. I hope you will enjoy and listen, and if you're a newcomer, I hope you enjoy this first episode, and you will go back and listen to our backlog of episodes, of which there are many, and if you're a returning listener, thank you guys, as always, for your continued support. It means a lot to me, personally. I don't have anything really to go over from last week. I do want to apologize again for the technical difficulties. I'm going to try and make sure I get some photos in this for the YouTube video, and of course, to anyone listening on audio, please rate 5 stars, download, like, whatever that helps support the show. I'd appreciate that. And on YouTube, if you could drop me a subscribe there, that'd be great. So this week, we will be finishing up kind of the steppe cultures between the years of 6 and 4,000. BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. And then, depending on the time, we may begin to transition to kind of the end of the steppe period. And then we'll move on. And when I say the end of the steppe, I mean where the Eurasian steppe ends at the Carpathian Mountains. Though it does continue a little bit south and kind of curves around to a little bit more hill country. Though, again, that depends on the time. And this is kind of one of those weird places where the geography is kind of a rough patch at that location because there are precursors to the last culture we'll talk about kind of in the steppe region. So it may be better to hold off for a week. We'll see how it goes. So just bear with me as we continue on this week. Now, about 200 years before the start of our season, the climate gets fairly moderate compared to, you know, what you might expect for the region. There's more rain, it's a little bit more fertile, not quite as cold during the winters, not quite as hot during the summers, that kind of thing. And this period is known as the Middle Volga culture. Now, it's not like a it's not a material culture like the way ones we've been talking about the last couple of weeks or in prior episodes this season. But you begin to see a shift at a number of sites to, you know, more sedentary, more complex hunter-gathering societies, as well as fishing thrown in, again, because most of these are on rivers, especially along the Volga. And like we've discussed the last couple of weeks, you do have other cultures moving in, but kind of the homegrown culture is known as the Middle Volga culture. And you see, I think they've discovered around 300 Neolithic sites. And again, there's not an overarching material complex through all these regions. Some of them have, you know, a little bit more stonework. Some of them have a little bit better pottery. But there's not like a single overarching connecting thread. These are peoples who are probably loosely related, and then you've had different groups coming in from the west, the south, and the southwest. And with that mix into the Middle Volga, including the Dnieper Donets culture, which we discussed last week, you begin to see along the middle, or a bend in the Middle Volga, or the Volga River, or right around the middle of the Volga, I should say, which is known as the Samara Bend, you do begin to see the region develop its own unique material culture. And this is known as the Samara culture, which again comes from the name of this bend in the middle of the Volga River. And this is a mix of peoples moving in that were part of Dnieper Donets migrations, and this homegrown early Neolithic Middle Volga peoples, as well as, you know, others from, you know, places in the east, as well as coming up from the Caucasus and the Pontic Sea, or the Black Sea. Now, try as I might, I really wasn't able to get a great etymology for this. You know, Samara is a city in Russia. It's also like an oblast in Russia. There's a couple of different Samara rivers. There's the Samara that's a tributary of the Dnieper, but then there's also the Samara River, which flows into kind of this bend in the Volga River, which is obviously what we're talking about now. The name is debated. It may be something like summer water, which the river freezes in winter, so obviously when it melts in the summer, there's water. That's not 100% accepted, but it is the one that, you know, I saw most often mentioned. Obviously, it's believed to be related to one of the Indo-European languages, maybe one of the later Indo-Iranians or perhaps Scythian languages. They're really not sure. But that's the one that I saw mentioned the most. And I really couldn't find anything else, you know, like a specific theory about what else it could mean. So just take that with kind of a grain of salt. Now, the Samara culture begins to become distinct right around 5000 BC, maybe a couple of hundred years earlier, 100 to 200 years earlier, depending on, you know, the kind of chronology you used. But again, people had been living here slightly earlier, and you know, it's not just Dnieper Donets people moving in. It's also them kind of assimilating or influence and being influenced by, you know, the old Mesolithic groups still living in the area, you know, or that had been living along the Volga for quite some time. Now, as we were talking about, there is a kind of a climate shift to make the area more hospitable. So that does lead to a little bit of agriculture being practiced, but by and large, it's mostly herding in the region that is being practiced. But of course, still plenty of hunting, gathering, and fishing going on as well. They had pottery as well. Most of their pottery is egg-shaped, so you couldn't really stand it flat on anything. So most likely they are putting it in, you know, with ropes or baskets or something along those lines to kind of help carry it or to keep it steady. You know, you could always use those ropes to kind of help carry it, sling it over your shoulders. It's possible they were, you know, carrying them on cattle, possibly horses too, which we'll dig into that in just a moment. But they did decorate it. They would either cut or use comb or kind of stab like little patterns into their pottery in kind of lines, and in some cases kind of almost like mountain peaks, almost little triangular patterns as well. Some people think this is kind of a sun motif. I don't see it, but again, I've had trouble finding a lot of their pottery in color, and the ones I have found in color, the lines don't really seem that solar to me. But they do have other, you know, art. They have some kind of carved figurines. In some cases, horses. Some maybe are some type of wildcat or wolf. It's kind of hard to tell, but it's some type of predatory animal. They also apparently are practicing some type of sacrifice. They are basically placing a head and the hooves of sheep, horses, and cattle in kind of very specifically made like shallow bowls, and they would put those over the human graves and then kind of cover those with ochre. So they are slaughtering animals and giving specific parts of them to their dead. And there are even they are even burying animals, specifically horses, in large numbers. Now, these are the earliest horse burials in Europe that we've determined. Now, why this is done isn't known, but that this is something that is often associated with Indo-European peoples, though other people do it at other times as well. Turkic peoples do it, Mongolian people, some of the other steppes out in Eastern Asia. Horse burials are not necessarily Indo-European, but these people would have been the first to do it. And we'll get into if these were the precursors of the Indo-Europeans in a couple episodes, but just bear that in mind. Now, in human graves, these also have shallow pits, at least at the start. That's what the humans are kind of buried in. And we talked about that last week. They're continuing with the shallow pits here, but they're usually burying a few individuals at once in a grave. Well, not necessarily at once, but they would bury, you know, up to three or four together. So they may have to dig people up, put new people in, and then they would start maybe another grave. Now, as time progresses, they begin to create stone cairns. After they buried the individual, they would kind of make a little mound of earth over them and then lay stones on top. And this is kind of a predecessor to what's known as a kurgan. Now, we'll talk about kurgan culture later. It's very important, especially when we talk about the Pontic-Caspian steppe, as well as Indo-European theories. But this is kind of the precursor to the kurgans. Now, last week we talked about the Nova Danilovka culture and how they were also beginning to place stone slabs over their dead, specifically men. But this is something a little bit different because, again, they are building up those mounds over their graves. Also, I didn't see any specific mention that it was thought that these burials were of people of a higher social status. Maybe they were, but it's just not mentioned in the literature I had access to. But in addition to burying animals with humans, they also had other types of grave offerings that they would bury with the individual and not necessarily over their graves. And these would include things like those figurines we mentioned. Also, there were pendants, beads, of course, flint and bone daggers. And usually these are placed either in the kind of at the arm of an individual or kind of above their head. And in some cases, they were even children's with weapons found in their grave. And that's kind of rare, at least at this earlier stage. And that's something that also becomes more common in other burial places later. And then, of course, you also have spearheads, arrowheads, in addition to daggers. Now, the Samara culture does enter into the Neolithic or the Copper Age. So copper does begin to show up kind of towards the tail end of the Samara culture. I think most of the copper they found is beads, although, again, towards the end, it's probable that they were beginning to make copper blades, tools, and things like that. Though very rudimentary, very crude, but they are in the Copper Age as they're beginning to disappear. And they, again, they last pretty much the entirety of the of this season. So they last from about 5,000, again, maybe 100 years, 200 years earlier, but they disappear right around 4,000 BCE. Though, not at all of their sites. Some of their sites are abandoned earlier, or not abandoned, but they begin to be associated with the next culture we're going to be talking about. This is one of those cases where there's some overlap between a culture and its predecessor. And it's likely that this next culture is an offshoot of the Samara culture, and that is the Covalence culture. Though that is perhaps a little oversimplified way of stating it, this is one of those things that is kind of heavily debated. Some people think the Covalence were an early offshoot of the Samara culture, and eventually they kind of became the dominant one and ended up phasing out the Samara. Then there are those that think the Covalence were a separate group that were influenced by the Samara culture, and then they took over. So it's not 100%. There's not a huge number of Samara sites. I think there's only like 5 or 6. And some of the dating at those is a little tough to do for whatever reason. And so then you have the Covalensk, which is a little bit more widespread and has a little bit better record, and or at least they found more objects of theirs to kind of study and observe and that kind of thing and record. Again, the dates are a little funky, and different people have different, you know, dating methods or, you know, dating theories. The earliest I've seen was 5000 BC, and then that person dates them between 5000 and 3800 BC, but then there are also people that have them a little bit later, maybe about 4900, 4800, and then lasting to about 3600. So, again, a little bit hazy on the chronology between these two and if they are, you know, how closely related they are. It's really hard to say. In terms of economy, they're very similar to the Samara. Mostly herding, with a little bit of agriculture thrown in, as well as, you know, traditional hunting, gathering, and fishing. Now, the Covalence group also, they expand a little bit more than the Samara to the east, and they get about as far west as the Samara did. But they do occupy a little bit larger of a range. And they do have more copper artifacts as well. We don't know exactly where they were getting their copper. But there are copper sources in the Urals and the Caucasus. So they at least had trade links to one of those locations. But again, probably, or maybe both. We can't say for sure. We know that people moving up from the Caucasus have got to the region. So it's possible, you know, this is a long scale, long term trading relationship. But that's not to say, you know, it's impossible that they also had contacts with peoples further east into the Urals. Now, like the people we discussed the last couple of weeks, Redney Sog and that, and the Dnieper Donets, these people are typically a little bit larger than you'll see in other Neolithic communities that are mainly practicing agriculture. They're getting a lot more protein and things like that from their more heavily meat-based diet. But DNA-wise, these people are generally consistent with what is known as Western steppe herders, which, as we talked about two weeks ago, that's a mixture of Eastern hunter-gatherer and Caucasian hunter-gatherers. So they do have some level of relation to, again, the people living along the Volga during the Mesolithic and Paleolithic, but also to these newcomers coming up from the Caucasus, and they have shifted away from a primarily hunting-gathering lifestyle to a herding lifestyle. Now, the name for this culture, of course, comes from the type site of Kovalensk, which is a town or city in Russia. That name is from the old Russian name for the Caspian Sea. They called it the Kovalen Sea, and that is believed to derive from the name Qualis, which was the name that they used for the people that inhabited Khwarezm, or the which later formed the Khwarezmian Empire. So that's where that comes from. We'll, of course, talk about the Khwarezm Empire much, much later. But they were primarily from what we call today Central Asia. So, you know, that does show that this is a very, very wide open region, and it's not hard to get to Europe from Central Asia, especially at this earlier period. Now, interestingly, Kovalensk is not really a community. It is a cemetery. It was around 932 square yards, which is about 780 square meters. And like we just mentioned a bit ago about the Samara, this is a full-on kurgan. And a kurgan is basically a large mound built up over time with dirt and stone and things like that. Similar to tells, except these are typically deliberately made and usually covering almost entirely human remains. And they found, 160 skeletons at the site. Most were buried individuals, but there were some with, you know, anywhere between 2 to 5 individuals buried together. They're buried on their backs with their knees kind of brought up to their chests. And again, some of them were covered with stone cairns, as well as areas where animal sacrifices were performed, where they would butcher animals and then bury parts of them outside of the graves. The graves would have grave goods and foods in them as well. The bodies would also have, or some of the bodies had ochre placed on them too, or I think most of them did. I don't know if all of them did. I saw most mentioned specifically. So individuals have grave goods, they had food in their graves, but then there were also some level of animal sacrifice. Now, you know, obviously some of that was probably shared amongst the people, you know, doing the interring as some type of funerary ceremony, but then some of the animal remains were given over to maybe the spirits or the gods in general, and then you had some of the portions were probably also given to the deceased, sharing one final meal together, as it were. Now, their pottery, a little bit better made, but by and large, it's fairly similar, at least in terms of designs and patterns. Still, most of them don't have flat bottoms, although the Kovalensk do have more flat bottom pottery than the Samara did, but they're still using kind of their strap or rope or basket carried kind of egg-shaped pottery. In terms of animals, it's the same ones we've been talking about: cattle, sheep, horses. Again, we're not sure if they're domesticated or not. That's a little bit of a debate. But they're still, if they are domesticated, they're very early strains. They're not being ridden, at least not for, you know, any long periods of time. They just couldn't bear the weight. Most likely they were used as pack animals if they were domesticated. And of course, all these animals would be, you know, killed and butchered for meat. They also have a little bit wider variety of types of jewelry. They have stone, like precious stones, jade, I think, is used in a couple of places, shells, animal teeth, a huge amount of bracelets made of animal teeth, as well as necklaces. And these would include, you know, things that are hunted boars, bears, wolf, as well as deer. It wasn't just, you know, predator animals, though I'm sure those were probably probably a little bit more prestigious because they were more difficult to acquire. But, you know, who really can say for sure? Copper is present among the Kovalensk, again, like we said. Though, again, this is appearing a little bit later, probably 4,500 to 4,000, you know, to the end, essentially. Of course, their use of copper becomes more widespread, gets a little bit better in terms of how they're making things, but they do enter into the Chalcolithic Age, or the Neolithic, whichever you prefer. Now, one thing I should mention about the Kurgan burials with the Kovalensk. Kurgans in later periods are not used, for the most part, as large-scale burials for, you know, members of a very large community. They become kind of a prestige aspect of burial. So you'll see chiefs, kings, and their descendants or family members get buried in kurgans. However, the earlier stages, this appears to be kind of a more egalitarian burial practice, where maybe everyone in a specific community gets placed into a kurgan. And these early kurgan burials, there's no sign that there is a chief buried among these people. Now, that's not to say there wasn't, but the chief doesn't have anything that makes him stand out. Pretty much everyone has kind of the same burial, you know, garb or you know, grave goods. They all have the same type of grave goods. There's nothing that stands out and says, this is something that only this person has. Now, that's not to say there's not disparities between those who have been buried. There are individuals that have more grave goods than others, and in some cases by quite a bit. And, you know, that shows that, A, the community is economically, at least among some people, prospering. And they're prospering, you know, well enough, at least a few of them, to be able to afford to let go of all of that and not just the bare minimum for their relatives' afterlife. And that kind of explains, you know, how they're able to expand better than the Samara, perhaps. You can kind of see the wealth with the dead, and you just have to imagine, you know, how much richer that, you know, the person that buried their father or their mother was than someone that maybe is burying their father or mother with less. So there are people who are doing better economically than other people in their community. And they may be the ones driving, you know, the expansion in other directions. Perhaps they need to, they have more wealth to give to their descendants, and maybe there's just not enough land around. Or maybe those that are economically less well off are the ones trying to forge out and reach new lands or pastures to perhaps have a chance of growing their herd. Maybe it's both. It's hard to say. Let's see, where are we at? Yep. Okay, so that's kind of the highlights between the Kovalensk and the Samara. I know it didn't really go into too much detail about them, but the thing is, they're kind of similar to some of the other people we've talked about the last couple of weeks. And I've kind of covered what makes them different compared to the other steppe peoples. And, you know, we've also talked about, you know, how alike they are, at least when it comes to economy. Though, again, the Samara and the Kovalensk certainly have access to much more copper, even during this season. And going forward, copper is going to be a big deal. We are entering the Copper Age coming up next season for most of the world. Not everywhere, but most of the world. And then from there, we're going to obviously transition to the Bronze Age, at least for, again, most of the world. But we still have some stuff to cover with the steppe. I was going to do the Kukutani Tripolye culture next week. along with their predecessors kind of at the end of the step. But I'm thinking it might behoove me to cover horse domestication, which is a process that is starting, if it not has not already been finished this season. Again, we're debating the time frames on this. As well as some genetic and linguistic stuff when it comes to the Proto-Indo-Europeans, what that means, what the popular perception of that is, and what it actually is to, you know, academics. So I think that might be the topic for next week. I'm still debating. So while I decide that, you guys just enjoy. Worst case scenario, we'll push that back to next week, and we'll finish up kind of the very terminus of the Eurasian steppe, and we'll get into kind of the border region between the steppe and the Balkans and the Carpathian Mountains and all that kind of stuff. So I hope you look forward to that. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X, or you can comment on the YouTube videos. I will respond there. And if you would all be so kind, again, to download, rate 5 stars, like, all that kind of good stuff, it really helps the channel out, and I do appreciate it a lot. But, yeah. I hope you all have a good rest of your week and day from whenever you're listening to this, and I'll see everyone next time. Peace.